So, as a starter question, who knows the two biggest groups of people that initially formed mainline American Presbyterianism? Anyone know? Anyone have a guess? Anyone? No guesses? No brave souls?
Church of England.
So, yeah, not just, I'm going to be more specific, not just the Church of England, but particularly English Puritans. That was one big group, which, of course, Church of England was made up of, at that time, of a lot of Puritans. Any other, one other group? Any other guesses?
Dutch Reform?
What's that?
The Dutch Reform?
That is a good guess, but it's wrong.
<I'm sorry.
laughs> That's why we're asking this. That's okay. But thank you for being brave and putting up a good suggestion. The Christian Reformed Church, the United Reformed Church, has a lot of the Dutch Reformed influence in it. And the United Reformed Church is a sister denomination of ours, and theologically are very like-minded. The other one is Scottish Presbyterians, or maybe even more specifically, Scotch-Irish Presbyterians. And so, really, it was actually the Scotch-Irish were even a bigger, in terms of initial people, a bigger group than the English Puritans, though there were certainly many English Puritans. And so these two groups came together in America to form what we call American Presbyterian history. And today our topic is going to be something that really isn't covering American Presbyterian history. What I mean by saying that is we're going to talk about the history that's going on in Great Britain today. And why are we talking about that? Well, it's because it's really the roots of American Presbyterian history. Those two groups of people that came over to the New World and ultimately set up American Presbyterian history had some history themselves before they got here. And that history is very important for understanding our own identity. You know, that's something Mike talked about last week, right? Our identity. What does it really mean to be a Presbyterian? And this is so important that we're going to spend 2 weeks on it. So today, I'm going to talk about what's called the Westminster Assembly. And next week, Mike is going to talk on Scottish and English Reformation. The Reformation work that was going on in the Church of England and the Church of Scotland. And some of that history. And so, you might remember, one of the things that Mike talked about last time in terms of our identity as Presbyterians. He talked about how we've been guided by the confessions, by our confession of faith and our doctrinal standards. And so we're going to talk about the history of how Presbyterians started confessing the Westminster Confession of Faith as their doctrinal standards. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that. That's what happened at the Westminster Assembly. That's what they produced. And so even though today's class on American Presbyterian history actually is going to spend time talking about what happened in Great Britain, it has a great impact on us today. And my hope is that we're going to talk and tie it all together. How does what was produced at the Westminster Assembly, how does that then relate to American Presbyterian history in our denomination, and it's in this thing called confessionalism. We're going to talk about what it means to be a confessional church and in what sense we're a confessional church. And that's where we're going to get hopefully into some application because that concept is still very relevant and very important for us today. So to talk about this thing called the Westminster Assembly, we have to first set some of the history. And if you have your little outline, you'll notice that's the first point, the historical setting of the Westminster Assembly. I suspect Mike will go into this a lot more in detail with you next week. I do want to just mention some of the history, though, as a background of talking about the Westminster Assembly. So, the English Reformation. You can cheat and look at your notes, but anybody remember what sparked the English Reformation? Oh, you already looked at the notes. Sarah.
The King Henry's divorce, trying to get a divorce.
Yeah, so King Henry VIII in England, he didn't have any heir. didn't have a child and blamed his wife, and so he wanted a divorce. And so I'm being very simplistic here, but the Pope wouldn't give him a divorce. And so, long story short, this is in the 1500s. Long story short, that by I think it was 1536. By the time 1536 came around, a series of acts of Parliament and political maneuvering, the Church of England was completely separated from the Roman Catholic Church. Now, when did Martin Luther post his 95 Theses? That's when Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Not 1492. Close, though. You are close. We will celebrate the 500th anniversary very soon. 1517. So in 2 years. No, 1 year. 1.5 years. It'll be the 500th anniversary of the posting. So realize what's going on then in Europe. About the same time as Martin Luther is causing an uproar for biblical truth, is about the same time that King Henry VIII wants to break away and does break away the Church of England from the Roman Catholic Church. And, of course, one of the things they did was they set up the Archbishop of Canterbury to basically be the new pope for the Church of England. And my point is that when the Church of England broke off, it wasn't over theological issues, right? It wasn't over like what Martin Luther was fighting for, justification by faith. And yet it was at about the same time. And so as they break off and start to redefine themselves now as the Church of England, there was other people who knew about the Reformation going on in the rest of Europe. And so naturally they start having that conversation. Well, if we're going to break away, what's our church going to look like? And so there were some initial reforms that took the Church of England away from what Roman Catholicism looked like. That being said, it didn't go far enough, certainly from our perspective. And so this brings us in, you see on your handout then, the Puritans. So what do you guys think of when you hear Puritans? What's that?
Burning
witches, okay. That's kind of what I wanted to hear. I wanted to hear what your guys' impressions are when you hear Puritans. Judy.
An effort to try to purify the Church of England.
Absolutely, an effort to try to purify the Church in England. That's right. And what I think we don't know as much about is the fact that, so again, putting that in the context of what we just said, the Church first broke away really more for political moral issues, for theological issues, but then that gave an opportunity for reform. But then the Puritans in the 1500s and 1600s came to the conclusion that the reforms hadn't gone far enough, that they needed more reform. The difficulty was is they didn't all agree on what the reform should look like. And so you had a lot of different parties. And I think this is something that we don't really realize as much, that we often think of Puritans as this kind of collective group, when in reality is there's a lot of different viewpoints among who we might call Puritans, and maybe the people we look up to in certain of those Puritans might fall into one or two of these categories and not some of these other ones. But the bottom line is there were some differences. So for some of the Puritans, a big issue was what the minister wears or doesn't wear. You know, there was very high church Roman Catholicism had a lot of vestments, you know, and so that was a big issue because a lot of the reformers were saying, no, we worship in spirit and in truth. And all this regalia that we wear is to miss the right way of worship. It's kind of a rabbit trail, but, the Genevan robe that Pastor Miller wore, that was a reaction toward the simple side. Just a simple, scholarly-looking robe versus all the ornate vestments that the Roman Catholics wore. Others were really just more focused on personal piety and thought there wasn't enough emphasis on that in the church. Another emphasis was over church government. Some were Presbyterian by nature. They wanted the church ran by a plurality of elders. Others were more congregationalist in model. There was issues over sermons. Do we actually let the pastors preach sermons, or do they have to read a pre-written sermon that is given to them by the church? Do they have to use the Book of Common Prayer? Or do they have freedom to do other things? Sabbath observance. You know, the King James wanted to use the time in the afternoon when everyone's all together. Let's have them do sports, since they're already together for church. After they're done in the afternoon, they go play church or go play sports, and that will let them be more prepared for battle when battle comes. So that wasn't a big fan. You know, Puritans were not a general big fan of that. And so these are some of the example issues. So, and then lastly, historical setting, we see the political turmoil. So I think this is also helpful to understand the background here. So England and Scotland, as of 1625, were united under one crown. What I mean by that is they were still two separate nations, but for intermarriage reasons, they ended up having one king. So there was a king of Scotland and a king of England, happened to be the same person. And if that seems strange, that's essentially what the Queen of England is right now over many nations in the world, right? She's the Queen of Canada. She's the Queen of Australia. She's the Queen of Great Britain. So, at any rate, that was part of the background there. So England and Scotland, because they had one king, though they had some aspects in which they were politically separate, they had a lot of common interest. And part of the interest was to try to unify around worship. That doesn't mean they actually succeeded in that effort, but that was at least one of the things that they were trying to do. Also at this time was the English Civil War. This was from 1642 to 1651. It was against the king, King Charles I. They didn't like what he was doing and his power that he was trying to assert, kind of this sort of totalitarian authority, and Parliament didn't like that. And part of what was the problem is his connections with Roman Catholicism seemed too much to people, that he had too much interest in influence, and that wasn't good for the church either. And so if you look there, the Westminster Assembly that we're talking about today began in 1643. So actually, it's technically during the time of the English Civil War. And in this standoff between Parliament and the king, and those loyal to the king. The Commonwealth of England then existed from 1649 to 1660, and this was a time where there was no king over England. The king was temporarily removed, at the end of 1660 is when Charles II is restored in the monarchy, and they go back to having kings again. So, getting then to actually talk about the Westminster Assembly, the Westminster Assembly is really an effort to unify a divided church and even to continue to try to unify the Church of Scotland and the Church of England into some similar doctrine and practice of worship. And so the Parliament, the English Parliament, without King Charles I's consent, calls for the assembly on June 12, 1643. And the members of the assembly, they were often referred to as the Westminster Divines. Maybe you guys have heard that before, the Westminster Divines. You see there, they had 121 ministers of the Church of England, six commissioners from the Church of Scotland, and 30 members of Parliament. And so this is like a long-standing work that they're doing over years, that this assembly has been formed and work is going on. And originally the intention here was that they would go and not only address some of the hot topic issues, like church government, for example, but to refine the 39 articles. The 39 articles, that was the doctrinal standard of the Church of England at the time. That's what they called it, the 39 articles. And so they were going to go and modify those, revise those, basically propose amendments. And as they got into their business, they realized this is more than just some amendments. We're going to have to start from scratch, essentially. So that's what they ultimately do. And so what did they actually accomplish? Well, there was a number of things they did, but we can summarize their biggest achievements in several documents, the first one being a form of church government. I do, by the way, if you want to look at any of this, I've got this little book here. It says Westminster Confession of Faith, it's actually got all the different main documents that they put together, as well as a few other documents in there. So if you want to look at any of the original versions. And maybe, by the way, let me step back. Where did the assembly meet? Why is it called the Westminster Assembly? Westminster Abbey, which is in London. That's right. Have any of you been to the Westminster Abbey in London before? No. I've been there. It's exciting. It's a very historic place. It's Gothic structure. And a lot of famous kings and other famous people are buried there under the abbey. And it's a lot of famous things have gone on at the Westminster Abbey. And it's just amazing, gorgeous, historic building, including the Westminster Assembly. That's where they did the work. So if you go there, you can ask them, can you show me the buildings, the rooms they used in the Westminster Assembly? They won't necessarily show you, but you can ask. I've heard some people have been allowed to see them. Others, they say, sorry, that's not open to the public. So, but they'll know what you're talking about. So, the first thing that they produced was a form of church government completed in 1643. I'm going to grab one of the little book here. We have the Book of Church Order, and this is for the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. And it's not the same edition, but this is built into several parts, and the first is the form of government. So the form of government that's in here is modeled after this form of church government that was completed here in this Westminster Assembly. And the form of church government that they decided upon is what we would call Presbyterianism, that local churches are ran by a group of elders, and there are then regional bodies called presbyteries and a general assembly that's over the whole body, but each of them are sending representatives of elders into those bigger or wider bodies. And so we have the same thing in our denomination. We have... we're part of the Presbytery of Northern California and Nevada. We have stated meetings twice a year. We and the other churches in our presbytery will send our elders as representatives to the presbytery meetings. And then once a year, it's a week-long assembly. We have a general assembly once a year somewhere in the country. It's each presbytery sends some of our elders to the assembly, and the work of the church is conducted that way. And the General Assembly obviously focuses more on the denomination-wide issues, but we focus, our church elder board focuses more on the local stuff here, and the presbytery focuses on the regional things. It's kind of a basic breakdown of responsibilities that way. So this form of church government was actually accepted by the Church of England at the time. It never got implemented. The monarchy got restored before it could get implemented. And guess what? When the monarchy got restored, Charles II said, we're not doing any of this Presbyterian government. And so that's why the Church of England today is still an Episcopalian form of government, which is what the Catholic Church is modeled after, a hierarchical structure. The second main document that they came up with was the Directory for Public Worship, and that was done by about 1644. And this, again, when you look at our... Book of Church Order, it's got a form of government and it's got a directory for public worship in here. And the directory for public worship in here is very similar. It's modeled after what they put together. And there are certainly some differences with our version, but it was influenced by this. And so this directory for public worship that they made in 1644, it was a big emphasis on the communal nature of worship, not individual worship. Nature of worship. You know, you go to some churches and you see a lot of individuality, you know, some people standing, some people sitting, some people raising arms, some people not, you know, and this is saying we're a congregation, we're coming together to corporately worship and we should do things together. It also emphasizes no holy days besides Sunday. This was a big emphasis by the Puritans, right? The Roman Catholic Church has a lot of holy days, a rather extensive calendar, and so they wanted to say, no, Sunday is the holy day that we get together and worship. So it also encouraged family worship, for families to be going and studying the scriptures and reading and singing to the Lord on a regular basis. It also advocates exclusive psalmody, which of course our denomination now also includes the use of hymns, but that was what they were advocating at the time. And behind this whole directory is what's called the regulative principle of worship. The idea is that we worship according to the way God tells us and not just make up things if it's not specified. In other words, we have freedom in a lot of areas, but when it comes to worship, we should really focus on worshiping the way God told us to worship. An example would be, think of the scriptures in Leviticus, Nadab and Abihu brought strange fire before the Lord in the tabernacle, and God struck them dead because they were bringing some form of worship that God had not said. And so God said, no, worship me the way I tell you to worship. And so that regulative principle of worship is behind this directory. Next one is the Westminster Confession of Faith. That was completed in 1647. And that's, again, what we have in our confession and catechisms. So we have the Westminster Confession of Faith and larger and shorter catechisms. What we have in here, we'll mention in a moment, have been modified slightly since then, but very, very minor amendments. I would use the language of amendments. There's been a few amendments, but in substance, it's the same document. Theology of the Westminster Confession of Faith, as well as the larger and shorter catechisms, the theology that's in there, it's very much what Lita was pointing out, consistent with the broader European Reformation tradition, including like the Dutch Reformed, people like John Calvin, John Knox. They were influenced a lot by Augustine and how he thought about the scriptures. And so certainly you can see that similar thread going on. It was Calvinistic in terms of its doctrine of predestination. It advocated covenant theology, seeing how the covenants and their outworking in history are a reflection of two bigger covenants going on. The covenant of works that happened in the garden when man was given the opportunity to show forth and earn his righteousness, but he failed. And then after that, the need for the covenant of grace, the need for a way for us to be redeemed and forgiven and made right with God, not by something we earn, but by the work of Jesus Christ, by a Redeemer. And so that was a significant part of that document. So that Westminster Confession of Faith was accepted, again, in both the Church of England and the Church of Scotland. But it never really took life in the Church of England because of the monarchy returning. It did take life in the Church of Scotland and had lasting influence. So then they also produced a larger catechism and a shorter catechism. And these catechisms are in question and answer format. So again, if you haven't been familiar with these before, some of the questions are very similar, so between the larger and the shorter. So the shorter says, what is man's chief end? Man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. That's the first question of the shorter. The larger isn't much different. What is the chief and highest end of man? Man's chief and highest end is to glorify God and fully to enjoy him forever. Those questions are almost identical. But as you go on, the larger catechism has 196 questions. The shorter catechism has 107 questions. And in general, the larger catechism, the questions and answers are much longer. So, for example, when you're in the Ten Commandments, it asks, you know, what's forbidden in the first commandment? And it'll list a general summary, and the shorter catechism might just be a couple sentences. The larger catechism might be a paragraph or two. It gets pretty meaty. And the idea was that the larger catechism could be used by people like pastors for training the people for their own, really, actually, to clarify, more for their understanding as they prepare to train the people. And the shorter catechism could be for the rest of the folks, particularly the kids. And I think this is interesting because, and maybe telling of our day, nowadays, if you look in the back of the table, you'll see that we have a kid's catechism. The kid's catechism is like, nowadays, in 2015, right, we think the shorter catechism is too much for our kids, so we made a kid's version of the shorter catechism, when the shorter catechism, in some sense, was made for the kids. But maybe it's a reflection of too much TV and internet and video games that we have trouble teaching our kids the shorter catechism anymore. But that was the idea. It was milk compared to the meat of the larger catechism. Interestingly, again, the catechisms were approved in England and Scotland. The Scottish did continue to make use of them, but England, same kind of thing. When the crown came, he stopped it. But interesting, in England, I don't know the reason for this. In the Parliament was divided up into two parts. The House of Commons approved both the larger and the shorter catechism. The Lords of the Parliament only approved the shorter catechism. I don't know the reason for that. Maybe someone can do a little research for us and find out. Okay, good. Any questions so far? I've been talking a lot. So let's talk a little bit about ongoing significance. The Church of England, we mentioned, initially accepted it, never really implemented it before it got taken away by the monarch coming back. Church of Scotland initially accepted all the documents, but when they had a revolution of their own in 1690, and when they reestablished the functioning, organized Church of Scotland, they, for whatever reason, I don't know if it was by oversight or by just trying to simplify or what, but they ended up only affirming the Westminster Confession. They didn't mention anything about the larger and shorter catechisms. So that's continuing the case right now. The Church of Scotland today does still continue to affirm the Westminster Confession of Faith, but they don't officially have the larger and shorter catechisms as their doctrinal standards. Just to clarify, the Church of Scotland today, even though they affirm that, their theology and practice in general is it's not the best. it's got, unfortunately, too much theological liberalism worked into it at this point. There are other bodies within Scotland that have made use of the Westminster Standards. The Westminster Standards is to refer to the Confession and the larger and shorter catechisms. One example is called the Free Church of Scotland. It's slightly different than the Church of Scotland. The Church of Scotland's the established by the government religion, the Free Church of Scotland, the one that's independent of that, but is really modeled in the best way of what the Church of Scotland should be, I guess, in terms of they actually do affirm these documents of the Westminster Assembly and seem to be pretty excited to continue to teach the theology that's behind those documents. Our denomination has some form of fraternal relations with that Free Church of Scotland. In other words, in England, the work of the Westminster Assembly, which was done by England at the command of England, really has not had any real lasting influence. That's the point there in the Church of England. But in the Church of Scotland, it has, in general, had a lot of ongoing significance and lasting influence. So I think that's pretty interesting. Now, when we come to American Presbyterianism, we'll talk more about this as we get into American Presbyterian history more, but they first adopted the Confession and Catechisms formally in 1729. It's before we were even a nation. It was then revised three times in 1789, 1887, and 1903. The first revision in 1789 reduced the strength of the civil magistrate. So you'll notice there's the Church of Scotland and the Church of England that are really established and sponsored in some sense by the nation of Scotland or England. America's not like that, right? We were very clear we didn't want a government-owned, established church. And so they reduced some of the language in there that would at all suggest any sort of establishment principle of the church. There's still high respect for the civil magistrate and its work, but wanting to emphasize they have a different responsibility than the church does. In 1887, the revision there was some revisions in terms of marriage, kind of a smaller revision in terms of how far, in terms of like cousins and stuff that you can marry, and there was some revision there. And then in 1903, unfortunately, there were some very bad revisions that removed some of the Calvinistic ideas in the Westminster Standards. And so that's in 1903 when theological liberalism was really taking off in the church. And so not only theological liberalism, but then kind of wanting to pull back from some of our more Calvinistic roots. And so when the OPC was formed in 1936, we rolled back most of those 1903 revisions. In other words, the document here that says Confession of Faith and Catechisms of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, most of those 1903 revisions were taken away. The only ones that were kept, there was something that said the Pope was the Antichrist. That was removed in 1903, and we kept that removal. I would say the Pope is at least a Antichrist. You know, we talked in 1 John, there are many Antichrists, and that there's this one final Antichrist. The original confession seemed to suggest he was that one final one, versus I think we can look in history and see that, yeah, they were right to recognize him as an Antichrist because he was pulling away from biblical religion and teaching something else. So the 1936 OPC edition is the same confession that when the PCA, our sister denomination, the PCA, was formed, they took what we had created in 1936, what we had settled upon in terms of what revisions to accept and not, and they used that one. So the Orthodox Presbyterian Church and the Presbyterian Church in America used the same version of the Westminster Standards. And the mainline Presbyterian Church, they continue to degrade in this area. They not only have their edited version from 1903 of the Westminster Confession, but they've since then created a whole book of confessions where they added some other Reformed confessions, and they've added some newer confessions that are not very good at all, frankly. And by having this whole book of confessions, really none of them has much weight anymore. They're kind of like this snapshot of the church in history, what they confessed at different points. But then by doing that, essentially waters down their strength altogether. So other thing to note is that Congregationalists took this document, the Westminster Standards, and they modified it a little bit, and they called it the Savoy Declaration. I might not be pronouncing that right. And that was in Savoy Declaration, 1658. And similarly, the Baptists took this Westminster Confession of Faith, made a little bit more modifications, and named it the Second London Baptist Confession of Faith of 1689. So this document was so influential, and they recognized the value in it, that they other groups took it and made some minor changes, or maybe minor's not the right word, but made some changes, but there's a lot of the substance that is the same, and it has been continued to be used even here in America, by some Congregationalist churches and some Baptist churches. Particularly Reformed Baptist churches often will make use of it because it is still their, what they produced is a very Calvinistic and Reformed perspective, besides, except for the facts that they, parts they took out to accommodate their Baptist views, of course. So, that's that. The last thing I wanted to mention, I said this is kind of the application here, is this notion of confessionalism. Confessionalism. The OPC is a confessional church. That means that we speak very clearly about what our church believes doctrinally. And we're saying, it's here right here, the Westminster Confession and the Larger and Shorter Catechisms, that is our confession of what we understand the Scriptures to mean, to teach, to be saying. And to clarify, when members come in, they don't have to affirm every jot and tittle of this, right? That's not in our membership questions. It is in the membership questions of the leaders. If you want to be an elder or a deacon or a pastor, you have to affirm that you believe these to be an accurate summary of the teachings of Scripture. And if you don't, well, then we just don't think you're fit, because we think that doctrine, you need to get the doctrine of the word right, and we believe that this is an accurate summary of that doctrine of the Scriptures. Now, how does this relate to the other principle we often talk about called sola scriptura? Right? We say that the Reformation Day, sola scriptura, the Scriptures are the foundation, not some other thing, not some other man-made product. There's where we go to find the source. How does this relate? What do you guys think? What do you think, Jerry?
I was just going to say,
well, okay, here's the point. Here's the point. In theory, what we're saying is that the Scriptures are, we're still saying sola scriptura, right? We're still saying the Scripture is the foundation. What we're saying is, and you know how it goes, you sit in a Bible study and you read a verse, and there's six views sometimes on certain passages. And so from a leadership standpoint, those interpretations that we think are necessary for a right working of the church, things like the gospel, we want to get right. And so we're saying that we believe what's in here is accurately summarizing the Scriptures. If it can be proven that it doesn't accurately summarize the Scriptures on some point, then guess what wins? The Scripture wins. And but we're saying with much study, you know, think of all the time that's been invested in this, you know, that we think this is a helpful, useful way to bring us together in unity over a right understanding of the Scriptures. And so it's not meant to supplant the Scriptures. It's meant to summarize the understanding of the Scriptures. And so a confessional church is saying that this is our understanding of the Scriptures. And this might be at odds versus churches that really have no confession. Or sometimes you see a church has like a little tiny half-page statement of faith. Now, I think statement of faith have a great purpose. I think they're great for, in general, telling people what somebody believes. Or they're great if like you want to have some interdenominational group that's going to help the poor from a sort of Christian flag, so to speak. I think those are great for uniting us together around causes like that. But in terms of the teaching of the church, having something more meaty, I think, is important. And that way you know what you're going to get. If you're here versus other Orthodox Presbyterian churches, or you go around, you know what you're going to get. And to call it confessional is important to note. It's confessionally reformed. What are we confessing? Because Lutherans are confessional, but they confess something different. Right? They have a different, Augsburg Confession, I think, is what they use. And so a church might be confessional. That doesn't mean that they're the same as us. What are they confessing? And so we're saying these are the confessional standards of the church. And so you can have varying types of confessional churches, and we're one who's confessionally reformed. Now, some dangers here. Sometimes we mentioned that confession can take on, in practice, a greater authority than it should. You know, there's a value where you can quote the confession as a shorthand of what the church understands about the Scriptures. But we always have to be careful that it doesn't actually become in place of the Scriptures. And so that's an ongoing, we have to make sure we guard ourselves against that. On the other hand, we can see some of the dangers of not having a confession. You can think of churches that have become so embroiled in conflict that they split and they split and they split over issues that it's like the church was first addressing for the first time, when these are things that have been addressed over, you know, if we put it in print what we actually believe, then no one's surprised when we teach that, right? So there's some of the pros and cons. And I'd love to say that doing this safeguards us from all error. But what's a good example that doing what we talked just there about confessing like that, how do we know it doesn't keep us from all error? Well, here's an example. The mainline Presbyterian church, they started in the same roots, right? Our roots relate back to them. And at some point, even though they had this same confession, they modified it here pretty badly. And then later on, they added all these other confessions and kind of essentially weakened the whole nature of the confessional church. And where they're at now is this extremely theologically liberal denomination that really, in terms of doctrine, is one of the least doctrinally strong churches in terms of anything almost goes in there. And if you, the only thing that doesn't go is if you hold strongly to doctrine, frankly. and particularly the doctrine of their roots. So we have to be careful that our pride isn't to trust in the confessions, right? We have to, even for our well-being as a church, we trust in the Lord. Trust in the Lord. The larger catechism says we need to be careful not to trust in lawful means. It's good to have a confession, but we don't put our trust in it. We put our trust in the Lord and in His Word. And so there are strengths and weaknesses here of being a Reformed, or confessionally Reformed church, but I hope we've been able to give you a taste of hopefully the pros outweigh the cons, and that this can be a great document for promoting the peace and the purity and unity in the church, that truth would be promoted from the pulpits and from the different teaching ministries of the church. So next week, like I said, Mike will talk more about Scottish, English, Presbyterian history. Let's pray.